It is Monday, July the 31st. This is VOA's International Edition. Many thanks for joining us. Coming up, can Russia and the U.S. get along?
I think it's going to be very difficult because there's such an imbalance in terms of their economic capability, in terms of democracy versus authoritarianism.
And violence and death overshadowing the voting in Venezuela.
It's a catastrophe, and I think it's the worst crisis that the hemisphere has seen in decades. And it's, I think, the worst crisis that you've seen in an oil exporter country that has not been going through a war.
Also ahead, social media trends and 64 years of music from the Four Tops. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Russian President Vladimir Putin said Sunday the United States would have to cut its embassies and consulate staff in Russia by 755. That's heightening tensions between Washington and Moscow 3 days after the U.S. Congress approved sanctions against Russia. Sergei Rybkov is the Russian deputy foreign minister. In 2002, he worked as a counselor in the Russian embassy here in Washington, and he appeared on the ABC News program This Week with George Stephanopoulos.
This retaliation is long, long overdue. After the Senate, the day before yesterday, voted, or rather on the 27th of July, voted so overwhelmingly on a completely weird and unacceptable piece of legislation, it was the last drop. If the U.S. side decides to move further towards further deterioration, we will answer, we will respond in kind.
And in response, the U.S. State Department deemed all of this, in their words, a regrettable and uncalled for act on Russia's part. For some perspective, VOA's Victor Beatty asked University of Denver Russia scholar Jonathan Adelman for his read on what's happening between Moscow and Washington.
But I think there's a deeper issue here, and there's an irony. And the irony, I think, is, as you well know, is that for Donald Trump, this is great. He's being accused of colluding with the Russians, doing all sorts of things. And by going along with this, he answers his detractors, who are very numerous at this time, and says, well, if I were so, why would I be punishing them? And so I think especially the new people that just came in to his group are saying, oh, this is great, because now, you know, the studies show, if you look at public opinion polling data, that Russia is not the main interest of the American public. It is about the economy. It's about jobs. It's about the future, you know, and so forth. And this is low down on the list, and it's going to push it lower.
Apparently, the only thing that's going to be impacted by these cuts, when they're made, September 1st or thereabouts, will be processing Russian applications to visit the U.S.
Absolutely. And that's something that's pretty powerful. And also, the Russians are showing that they are tough. We can do more of this, even though there's a huge gap between the two countries. The United States is over $18 trillion economy. Russia's about $1.5 trillion economy. They did a poll in Russia recently that said that 25% of Russians want to emigrate and leave the country, and 11 million have since 1991. So the Russians are, you know, trying to show how tough they are and that they really haven't been, you know, gone downhill as they really have in the last, you know, 2 decades.
President Trump and Secretary of State Rex Tillerson have expressed numerous times their desire to improve relations with Russia, which sank to lows during the previous Obama administration. They talked about cooperation in the area of cyber crime, also in space. Is it possible that these two countries can have good relations?
I think it's going to be very difficult because there's such an imbalance in terms of their economic capability, in terms of, you know, the democracy versus authoritarianism. But I think eventually that'll be the case. But I think for this administration, and when you look at the hardliners, very tough people who just joined this administration, you know, John Kelly and Anthony Scaramucci, they're going to be telling Donald, don't do anything until you get past this issue about collusion, because that is something which the Republicans have been, you know, pushed very hard on by the Democrats. And so they may even say in quiet that they're relieved. Let Putin come on after us. That way we can get rid of this and go to our issue, which is Hillary Clinton and the Russians. I mean, this nonsense goes on forever.
Moscow repeatedly denies involvement in the U.S. election of last year. Do you believe them?
No. I don't think the Russians really seriously think that we're going to believe that. What the serious question is, did they really have an impact on the outcome of the election? And I think that's going to be something that we've got a number of, studies coming up by the House, by the Senate, and by other committees, and it'll be fascinating. But there's one trouble with that whole issue, and that is undoubtedly the Russians did some things. But whether they made a difference, whether they impacted in the 3,007 counties across this country, that's a very good question. And it's important not only for the election in 2016, it's even more important for 2020, because it's found that Russia or some other country can do that. That's a huge problem for a country as democratic as the United States is, and proud of it.
Jonathan Adelman is a professor at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies, the University of Denver. Part of his research is in comparative politics, the history of the Soviet Union, and Russian foreign and defense policies. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. Venezuelans stayed away from the polls in large numbers on Sunday in a show of protest against a vote to grant President Nicolas Maduro's ruling Socialist Party virtually unlimited powers. Protest, violence, and even, according to some, death overshadowed voting to elect a 545-member Constituent Assembly to rewrite the country's constitution. All of this in the face of a brutal economic crisis. Brookings Institution Fellow for Global Economy and Development Danny Behar, a native of Venezuela, recently wrote the Venezuelan economy is a disaster. In a Brookings podcast, Behar talks about how he determined that.
It's a catastrophe, and I think it's the worst crisis that the hemisphere has seen in decades. And it's, I think, the worst crisis that you've seen in an oil exporter country that has not been going through a war. So the country has lost about 30% of its GDP in about 4 years. And I think one statistic that it's very scary, but I think it summarizes a lot, is that 75% of Venezuelans have lost up to 20 pounds in weight because there's not enough food. A lot of people are dying from preventable diseases, completely preventable diseases. There was very good reporting by the New York Times really showing the state of the public hospitals and how people are... Babies are dying, infant mortality has gone up, and poverty has gone back to levels that they were 20 years ago.
And how does all of this happen in a modern country, which has at times been described as a democracy?
Yeah, well, it's not a democracy anymore, but this is a man-made crisis. The crisis really started or kicked off when the prices of oil went down. Oil is more than 95% of Venezuelan exports. The real crisis started in 2014, but what I always say in my writings and when I talk to people is that this crisis is not because the price of oil went down. This crisis is because 2 decades of really mismanagement of a country. Just to make the story short for our listeners, the country elected in 1999 Hugo Chavez, and he stayed in power until he died in 2013, and then Maduro, he's appointed here. They really did a lot of mismanagement. They enjoyed the highest and longest oil boom in the history of the country. The price of oil was very high during the 2000s. But they did exactly the opposite of what any Economics 101 textbook will tell you. So in the good times, when a lot of money was flowing in, instead of saving, they actually increased their expenditures dramatically, and they had to borrow a lot of money.
And does the Maduro government have an explanation for all of this?
You know, if you ask them, they will start blaming the imperialism and that there's an economic war against Venezuela. You know, Venezuela has one of the highest inflations in the world because they have a huge fiscal deficit. The government is spending much more than what they're gathering through taxes. They keep saying all the things that the country is under an economic war and the United States and the imperialism are trying to rob them and the opposition and the oligarchy, all this, you know, speech that we've seen in many of these dictatorial countries that don't want to take real responsibility for what's happening.
Danny Bahar is a Brookings Institution Fellow for Global Economy and Development. You can have more of his comments and read what he writes at brookings.edu.
VOA podcasts are a convenient way to get your information on the run.
VOANews.com.
Visit VOANews.com and click on podcasts to learn how you can subscribe.
U.S. Republican-held Congress running out of time now to finish major legislative initiatives like health care overhaul and tax reform, two key pledges of President Trump's campaign platform. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman talks now with VOA's Jim Stevenson, and he tells him the Senate this past week heard from an ailing Republican veteran on how to get back on track after months of bickering.
John McCain's return to the Senate this past week was highly anticipated because, of course, he is a revered man and he has been in the institution for a very long time. He has been a standard bearer of the Republican Party, and he had this devastating cancer diagnosis, a particularly lethal form of brain cancer. And yet just a few days after that diagnosis, he shows up in Washington. Just as the decisive votes are going to be cast in the healthcare debate, he first voted to begin debate. But at the same time, he delivered this speech saying that the entire process by which Republicans were attempting to change the healthcare system was flawed. It was relying only on Republicans, that it should be bipartisan. And then a few days later, when it came to actually voting on a Republican plan that would have repealed key segments of Obamacare, John McCain voted no. And he sort of solidified his maverick status, which was the way that he liked to be regarded during the 2008 presidential campaign when he ran against Barack Obama. And ironically enough, the man who may have saved Obamacare could be the man who was defeated by Barack Obama in 2008, John McCain.
Now we also have work beginning on the much anticipated economic package.
Jim, we are in the waning few hours of July, which means August is just around the corner. Traditionally, both houses of Congress are gone for the entire month of August and actually into the first week of September. Here is what is on the plate just for the coming months. Congress has to pass a spending bill. Congress has to deal with the fact that America's spending authority, the U.S. government's spending authority, is reaching its limit. It's reaching its ceiling. So the debt ceiling has to be increased. If President Trump wants any sort of tax reform, which was one of the sort of centerpieces of his campaign and something that Republicans have been dreaming of for years, that is something that must be tackled very shortly. If there's to be any kind of infrastructure package, that has to be tackled. And all of this is happening during what I think we can fairly say is a period of fairly intense chaos within the White House and some really strained relationships between President Trump and the men who should be his top lieutenants on Capitol Hill. I don't know how this extremely ambitious agenda, and it was ambitious back in January when Donald Trump raised his hand and took the oath of office. So much has happened since then. We have a White House with sort of a revolving door of who is actually serving President Trump. All of this chaos, it's going to be very interesting to see how Republicans try to deal with arguably the most ambitious legislative agenda attempted by anybody in recent memory in such a short period of time.
On the surface, you would think a Republican-held White House, Senate, House of Representatives, it would be a breeze.
Well, it would be a breeze in the parliamentary system, but of course we don't have the parliamentary system. Legislation has to go through two houses of Congress. And let's not forget that, you know, trying to get lawmakers to agree on anything is somewhat like herding cats. Let's also not forget that Republicans are trying to do genuinely big ticket things. We're not talking about renaming post offices. If you're talking about restructuring America's healthcare system, well, gosh, that accounts for 1/6 of the U.S. economy. If you're talking about restructuring America's tax system, well, that's thousands upon thousands upon thousands of pages long. And there are vested interests in all of this. This is not in any way an easy lift, and Republicans are starting to realize that.
Despite the seeming dysfunction on the Hill and in the White House, things run smoothly at the VOA Senate booth, and Michael Bowman is there each and every day, and we are honored to be able to chat with you each week.
Always a pleasure, Jim. Thank you.
Yes, indeed. It's a pleasure to have both of you. Time now to change our attention to social media, and my colleague Lori London here with the latest trends.
A couple of interesting stories about how far-reaching the impact can be of social media. We start with Charlie Gard, the British infant who died last week after becoming the subject of a worldwide ethical and legal debate regarding his fate. Now, his parents wanted to take him to the United States for experimental treatment, but the hospital in London argued it would only prolong the inevitable, and the courts in London sided with the hospital. Now, the story and the parents' continued fight went viral on social media, with the hashtag CharlieGard tweeted at least 500,000 times last month alone. People from all over the world weighed in, including the Pope, who tweeted, quote, "To defend human life above all when it is wounded by illness is a duty of love that God entrusts to all." Now, the Pope's tweet itself led to a 285% rise in one day for online searches of Charlie Gard. Now, President Trump also tweeted that the U.S. would be glad to help. So the magnitude of how many people from all over the world were weighing in prompted the judge presiding over the case to actually speak out against this sort of thing being debated on social media on what he called ill-informed online comments. The judge even referencing comments about Charlie's fate being in the hands of Britain's health system, saying the comments were absurd. And another interesting story about the impact of social media, a federal judge in Virginia has handed down a verdict against a state official that could have implications as far-reaching as the president. The judge ruled that the official violated the First Amendment, or freedom of speech, of one of her constituents by blocking that person on Facebook. The judge ruled that many of the official's posts were related to issues involving the government that they needed to be open to the public. Why this is especially interesting is that there is a similar lawsuit pending against President Trump by a First Amendment group on behalf of hundreds of Twitter users that he's blocked from his own personal page. But the president uses his @RealDonaldTrump account to actually talk about government-related issues, including his recent tweet about the U.S. military no longer allowing transgender people to serve in the military. So that's where the same sort of thing could potentially apply. We'll have to see how this plays out in the courts and if this case will also prove to be in violation of the First Amendment, but it is certainly a new world with a president who uses social media and Twitter in particular as a major platform for communicating to the public.
And many thanks to you, Lori. VOA's Lori London. You can follow Lori on Twitter @LoriLondon. That's LUNDIN. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. Our program, International Edition, can be found at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The Breakthrough Starshot program say they successfully launched a number of tiny space probes into low Earth orbit on June 23rd. Each of these miniature probes, called Sprites, are built on a single 3.5 by 3.5 centimeter circuit board. Although the sprites only weigh about 4 grams each, they contain items needed for interstellar missions, such as solar panels, computers, sensors, and radios. Breakthrough Starshots say the sprites will help them develop even smaller 1-centimeter and gram probes they plan to eventually send on a 20-year voyage to explore deep space and search for life in the universe. Renowned physicist and cosmologist Stephen Hawking and Russian internet investor and physicist Yuri Milner announced the Breakthrough Starshot program back in April of 2016. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. It's time for our music department report, and it's 6 decades of music from an iconic group. The Motown Museum website, it is written, the Four Tops started their musical career at a house party in 1953. Members included Levi Stubbs, Duke Fakir, Obie Benson, and Lawrence Payton. The Four Tops stuck to singing standards and ballads and worked with 4 record companies until Berry Gordy signed them to Motown Records in 1963. The guys were all natives of Detroit, Michigan, Motown getting its name from Detroit, which was known as America's Motor City. Ain't No Woman Like the One I've Got was a big hit for the Four Tops while with Motown, which many said developed its special sound because of groups like the Four Tops. Another super hit for the group, Reach Out and I'll Be There.
Come on, everybody, put your hands together like this.
Tops stayed together until 1997, when on June 20th, Lawrence Payton died. The group continued to perform for a while with only 3 singers until Theo Peoples, who had been part of the singing group The Temptations, was recruited. Eventually took over the role of lead singer when Stubbs suffered a stroke in 2000, with Ronnie McNear then joining the group. In 2005, Benson died of lung cancer. Payton's son, Roquel Payton, replaced him. Levi Stubbs died in 2008. Fakir, McNear, Roquel Payton, and Harold Spike Bonnert, who replaced Peoples in 2011, are still performing together this day as the Four Tops. Fakir, the only founding member of the original group. When they were the original Four Tops, Baby, I Need Your Loving was a chart topper. I always say we wouldn't have had love music in the 1960s if it hadn't been for Motown. Love the Four Tops. Listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. For our director Tracy Carter, our engineer Greg Burns, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Monday. Now some more of those Four Tops.
'Cause lately I've been losing sleep. Has all been hers. Darling, I can't go on without you. This emptiness won't let me live without you. This loneliness inside, darling, makes me feel half alive. Baby, I need your love.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Haitians will get a boost in nutrition thanks to a joint program between United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, and Government of Haiti. On July 21st, U.S. Chargé d'Affaires Brian Shukin joined with Haiti's Ministry of Health, USAID, and RANFOS, the first food fortification project of Haiti. RANFOS will increase the availability of high-quality fortified staple foods across the country and expand the local production and importation of fortified foods. The project will work with the private sector, including local food producers and importers, to ensure the market viability to reach a wide population throughout the country, said Shukin. RANFOS directly contributes to the Government of Haiti-led efforts to improve the nutrition, health, and food security per the Government of Haiti's Nutrition Strategic Plan 2013 to 2018. The project aims to decrease deficiencies in micronutrients, which play a vital role in the well-being of children, mothers, and other individuals. For over a year, USAID has been working with the Ministry of Health and other partners, such as the United Nations Children's Fund, to develop a food fortification activity. In a recently released study financed by the Canadian Embassy, the Copenhagen Consensus Center identified food fortification, specifically wheat flour with iron, as one of the most efficient investments in Haiti's development. The RANFOS project will focus on fortifying wheat flour with iron and folic acid, vegetable oils with vitamin A, and salt with iodine. USAID will work with partners of the Americas and Global Alliance for Improved Nutrition to implement this $4 million four-year health and nutrition project. USAID is devoted to working closely with the Haitian government to ensure the sustainability of these joint efforts to improve the nutritional status of the entire population.
Additional programs in which USAID collaborates with the government of Haiti to promote nutrition and combat malnutrition include a food pyramid guide for consuming nutritious local foods and a voucher safety net program to increase access to locally produced foods among vulnerable households. The U.S. is proud to work with its partner, Haiti, to help the people of Haiti meet their important nutrition needs.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.